And he had this line that he used all the time. And he'd say, look, the three most important things on an astrophotography system. Number one is the mount. Number two is the mount. Number three is the mount.
How to mount your telescope is one of the most important considerations any amateur astronomer faces, and it can be a rather daunting and confusing situation when you're trying to figure out what's best for you and your telescope. Well, in this episode, Dustin and I sit down and talk to you about all sorts of things related to mounting your optical tube assembly. We will introduce you to the types of mounts and what characteristics to look for in a mount and why they're so important in this episode. Before I start the episode, I just wanted to say that this episode was live streamed on the Clear Skies Network Twitch channel, which I would encourage you to subscribe to if you'd like to interact with us while we're streaming. We can answer questions and we can talk with you about all sorts of fun things while we're streaming. So I would highly recommend going over to twitch.tv/clearskiesnetwork and giving us a quick sub. We would certainly appreciate it. All right, so let's get started. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Space Junk, a weekly podcast dedicated to the amazing hobby of amateur astronomy. Each week, we'll bring you interesting and fun discussions with an eye towards providing you with the latest information and advice on the tools, gadgets, software, and techniques for maximizing your enjoyment of the night sky. Your hosts are Tony Darnell from deepastronomy.space and Dustin Gibson from OPT Telescopes, a world leader in telescopes and accessories. All right, everybody, welcome back. Today in this episode, Dustin and I are going to chat with you about mounting your telescope. And regardless of how that sounds, what we mean is we are talking about putting an optical tube assembly on a device that counteracts the rotation of the Earth. What else would I be talking about? Okay. What else would I be talking about? Are you there, Dustin?
Help me out, man. I don't even know what to say, man. Yeah. Another episode. Here we go.
Mounting Your Telescope by Dustin and Tony.
Okay. I like how you put my name first, like I had any part of that.
Okay. Yes. Well, seriously, though, when you are looking at to either purchase a telescope or whether it's for imaging or for observing visually, the mount is, in my opinion, every bit as important, if not more important, than what you choose for an optical tube assembly. And the reason I say that is that optical tube assemblies are getting so great now by the Apo refractors that we're seeing, certainly a lot of the refractor telescopes, the Maksutovs and the Ritchie Crichton designs, all of them superb telescopes off the shelf. What makes them outstanding and is the mount that they're sitting on, whether they are mounted correctly, and we're going to talk about why that's a big deal. And I would even go so far as to say it's more important than the optical tube assembly you pick. What do you think, Dustin?
You know, we have who's still a dear friend of mine, Larry. He's with the company Planewave. He was with OPT over a decade, and he used to tell everybody. I remember being in the building, and I'd hear him pick up the phone, and people would always ask the same question, which was, you know, what telescope should I buy when I'm getting started? And he had this line that he used all the time. And he'd say, look, the three most important things on an astrophotography system, number one is the mount. Number two is the mount. Number three is the mount. And he would say that every day, man. I've heard it so many times. And, you know, it's funny, but it's true. And it's not the thing that people want to hear because it's not the most fun thing to buy. You know, it's not the most fun thing for most people, at least, to research, like the telescopes and the cameras. They're kind of like that fun part, especially for photographers, because it's the camera and the lens, you know? And so it's fun and it's more of what we've been trained to look at. We know more about the specs and it's a little more like it's easier to understand, I think, to go from photography to astrophotography and to research those pieces. But now there's this new piece, the mount, where you have to have this object that can carry, you know, a certain capacity. So you have to understand how much your stuff weighs. And then you have to understand its tracking capability. It has to, you know, rotate the exact rate the Earth is moving, but in the opposite direction, which is literally its function, to stop the apparent motion of the sky as the Earth spins. And it is so incredibly important, but I think it's still one of the least understood aspects of astrophotography. It's generally the thing that most people know the least about, because I think it's just a little bit further from what you're forced to learn when doing photography. You're always, you know, most people start by learning their cameras and learning their lenses. So they learn about f-ratio, you know, aperture, all this stuff. But there's really no need until you get into astrophotography to understand the finer details of mount technology. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that today, right?
That's right. And you can, with the kinds of optical systems and the cameras that are out there, you certainly need to understand things like exposure times and focal ratios and pixel scale and all of those things that are important to getting a good image. But you can make a lot more mistakes with that part of the imaging process and recover in post-processing. But it doesn't matter how good you've done all of that stuff on your optical system and camera setup if your mount is no good, because you cannot correct in software after the fact a poorly taken image that doesn't track properly or he's got all kinds of jiggle errors. And these are technical terms, by the way. Jiggle error is something, you know,
error in my system again.
Yeah. Well, I said my right elbow too. It's like, I must be going to rain soon. But yeah,
14 arc seconds. Jiggle error.
But you can't fix that stuff. You can't take that stuff out. If you've got a tracking error, star trails or zigzaggy images because of periodic error, you can't really correct that very well. So it's good to get this right the first time.
And it's true that you can take a decent camera and a decent telescope and put it on a phenomenal mount and get great images. But the reverse is not true. You could put a $100,000 camera and telescope system on a bad mount and every image is going to be unusable. You know, and so it is very, very important. And I would agree with what he used to say, that the mount is really, it's the foundation of your system and everything should be built around that, not the other way around. It shouldn't be built around the camera. It shouldn't be built around the telescope necessarily, unless you have a very particular shot in mind and you know exactly the focal length or f-ratio that you're going after. I think most people really should start with the mount. Because it's how often you can use it is going to be determined by, you know, things like portability. How, you know, like for you, you know, we just sent you that 20-inch Dob, Tony. That thing is not portable. So we were just talking about how often you could take that to a local, you know, city or to a, you were talking about bringing it to a brewery. Sure, but you can't do that every day because it's too big. It's not portable. It's not practical to bring a 7-foot tall telescope down the street. You know, and whereas people that are building their system from the ground up with a specific purpose in mind, starting with the mount, that's going to be the heaviest piece of equipment, you know, out that you own, then that's a really good place to start as the foundation of how are you going to be using this and what's your intention. And I think there are a ton of different options and the people that do this are rewarded for this decision every single time they take the equipment out.
Yeah. If you can give a lot of thought and budget to the mount first, you won't regret that decision because it will pay for itself many times over. At its most basic, a mount will hold the optical tube assembly that you've bought, the telescope itself. There are different kinds of mounts. There are manual ones that can be basically a tripod with something like a fork on it that you can move around in altitude and azimuth. Those are the simplest. And then you can have some with clock drives on them. And the clock drives, as Dustin said earlier, counteract the rotation of the Earth. And then there are different styles. There's alt-azimuth mounts and there's polar-aligned mounts. All of these do different things, but in different ways, but they're all designed to keep an image, a star, an object in your eyepiece while the Earth turns for several hours. So that's what a mount is supposed to do. And what you're going to use a telescope for will largely determine, along with your budget, what you end up getting. Now, if you've got a relatively smaller telescope, like some of these like 4-inch APOs or things like that, or even some of the compound telescopes like Schmidt-Cassegrain's and the RC telescopes, you can get away with a smaller mount that is also very portable. And some of them are quite sophisticated, like they have go-to capabilities. These are, this is a term that people use, and this is for beginners, where if you don't know where something is in the night sky, a go-to mount will learn where it is under the sky, when it is, what day it is, and then it will start finding things for you. You don't have to know anything about it. You just punch it into a computer or a hand pad. That's a go-to telescope.
Yeah, so, go to Saturn, right? And then you punch it in Saturn, and then there it goes. You watch the telescope move. It's almost like reverse GPS. It's like, there it goes. You watch it move, and then when you go look in the eyepiece, there's Saturn. And yeah, go-to really makes it easy. And it's almost one of those things that I feel like some people are against, because they're like, well, if you do that, you're not going to learn the night sky. You know?
Yeah, harumphers and I can, do that.
Yeah, I can see what they're saying, because a Dobsonian that isn't go-to, it really forces you to learn where things are. And that's pretty cool, but I don't think that it makes a lot of sense to say, well, we have this, you know, this technological advantage that can help you enjoy the hobby more with less effort or less nights out where you're not getting to maximize your equipment because you haven't, you know, met this threshold of knowledge yet. I don't think that it's a very good argument. It's like saying, you know, if our cars were like the Flintstone cars, you know, we would get a lot better cardio, and it's really good for heart health
and better gas mileage.
Yeah, it's better gas mileage. It's better in a lot of ways. I just really am against using vehicles that are powered, you know, and it's like, you know, sure, sure. But it's not a very good argument.
Flintstones car. I'm surprised you know about the Flintstones, actually. That seems to be way before your time, but that's good. All right, well, so, and there is one other style of mount that I should mention that Dustin alluded to with Dobsonians, and that is basically an altitude azimuth mount that it looks like a tube that's been put on top of a box. They're very simple looking telescopes. One look at them and you know how the mount works. You just swivel it around and move the tube up and down. And that is a mount. It's a very simple mount, and it's one that you have to manually push the optical tube around to keep the star in the field of view, but that is a style of mount. So what do you think, Dustin, would be, let's talk to beginners first. Someone comes into the store and they want a decent telescope that has some of these mount capabilities. What sort of characteristics that you point them towards?
Yeah, and so we really are starting here at true beginner, where you're learning the vocabulary. And that's, you've already mentioned a few words that I think we might take for granted, that there's no reason to know these words unless you're in this hobby or something very similar, like equatorial. Altaz, you know, like when are people doing anything with mounts that, like, most people understand tripod for photography. They understand like a tripod gives the camera stability, and that stability rewards the image with better sharpness. So you carry a tripod out there, you set it down, and it gives you something to put the camera on. A mount is just a tripod that moves. That's it. Its only function is to hold everything stable, but also counteract the rotation of the earth, because that makes the sky look like it's moving. So if you move the opposite direction at the same rate, it makes the sky look like it stops so that you can take a longer photo. And that's really the function of a mount, or you can track the objects across the sky, right? That's the other function. So I think that starting there and then learning the different types, that's where everybody should begin. Because the first thing you're going to do when you start looking for a mount is you're going to see that some are Altaz, and then some are equatorial. That's categories, you know, subcategories number one. So you have mount as the top category. Subcategory A and B would be Altaz, equatorial. And let's start there, because Altaz didn't mean anything to me when I got into the hobby. All it means is left, right, up and down. And so it moves on those axes. And so you can turn it left and right, and you can turn it up and down. And if you think about it, you want to point something anywhere in the sky. As long as you can move left and right and up and down, you can point it to wherever it is you want to look in the sky. And equatorial, this is how I describe it to the team, but equatorial is just left, right, up, down, tilted back a little bit, laid back in a recliner. It really is the same thing. It's just you're tilting it back at the same to whatever latitude you're at so that it's tilted at the Earth's axis, right? So to the you're pointed at Polaris, you're on the polar axis so that as the Earth is rotating, you don't have that you don't have rotation in the sky because you're actually tilted the same way the Earth is tilted to the polar axis. And so it's still moving the same way, but that tilting causes a very interesting thing to happen when you try to control it. If you're not used to it being, you know, tilted back equatorially, it's very hard to grasp the first couple times you do it, how the movement will work. And so with Altaz, it's very natural. Like everybody, everything we do moves left, right, or up and down. And so it's very natural. And you get it something like a Dobsonian, literally zero learning curve. You know, you go outside and it's like Tony just said, you just point it. It moves left, right. Yeah. It moves up and down. You just point it at whatever you want to see and it moves the way you think it will. But yeah, because you can't walk up. Yeah, exactly. But because you can't walk up to an equatorial mount and just swing it to the right or swing it to the left because it's tilted back on that axis, it takes some, you know, really, you got to get used to this new idea that this thing is laid back at 30 degrees or 40 degrees or whatever it is, right? It's a little bit different.
Yeah, the equatorial mount adds a different layer of complexity to what you're trying to do. It needs to be aligned to the polar, the north polar axis rotation. A altazimuth mount does not need to be polar aligned, so you don't have to worry about that. That's why they tend to be really good beginner telescopes. You can just do what Dustin says. You just move it around and point it. But an equatorial mount to be used properly and not to make it harder for yourself needs to be polar aligned. And that's a layer that you need to consider. Why would you want one over the other? Well, the real difference, in my opinion, and you can correct me if you've got a different opinion about this, Dustin, but sure, the real difference is that if you're an imager and if you're going to be looking at something for a really, really long time and you've got this really nice altazimuth mount that is tracking the stars for you, you're going, without polar alignment, you're going to get something called field rotation. That means that the stars will slowly turn, rotate a little bit as the Earth turns because you're not correcting for both axes. You're only correcting for, I mean, you're not correcting for any axes. You're just watching this rotate, the rotation of the stars go by. A polar aligned mount will not have that rotation in it. So, and that matters if you've got, say, like what Dustin does a lot, which is take hour long and longer images, that becomes an issue. You need to fix that with an equatorial mount.
Well, it's a really interesting concept that you don't think about until you're actually out there imaging. But with an Altaz mount that moves left, right, up, and down, you think about it, that's not the motion of the stars. I mean, everybody's watched the moon track across the sky. And so let's replicate this for a second. We know that the stars move across the sky in an arc, right? So it's not a straight line. It's an arc across the sky. Same thing with the sun. You see it arc down to the west, and you see it coming up on the east, but it follows this arc across the sky. And it's hard to comprehend with something like the moon because it's a circle, but let's change the shape just to understand what's happening. Okay, let's make it a triangle for a second. And we're going to color the top of the triangle a different color. So the top of the triangle is red. And so we're going to take a picture of it as it comes up. And when it's coming up on the left side of the arc, we can see that that triangle is pointed to the left and that red tip is at the top and the left. And then when it gets to the very top of its arc, now the triangle is straight up and down. And the top, the tip, that red tip is pointed straight up. But then as it arcs down, you can see that the tip starts to lean to the right. And now all of a sudden, you know, it's the complete opposite of where it started when it was coming up. And that's the nature of things moving in an arc. Just because, you know, these things are circular doesn't mean that they're still not changing their orientation as they move across the sky. But think if you took an image of it when it's on the left side of the sky, and you took an image when it's on the west side of the sky, and now you're trying to stack those two images, you see how they're not the same shape. Because you've got, you know, the red side is on the top left when you're on the east of the sky, and then it's the red tip is on the top right, when you're on the other side of the sky, so you try to stack those, it's not going to line up. And that's rotation. What's happening is it's rotating across that arc. And that's why you have an equatorial mount, is that you're on that polar axis so that the mount is actually moving in the same arc that the stars are. And so whatever orientation, wherever you point to, you're going to move in the same arc that the stars are. And so no matter where you are, you can stack and combine those images without any rotation in the image.
So why should you get one over the other? What's the difference between one over the other? Well, if you're an imager and you're going to take long exposure images, then the equatorial mount makes a whole lot more sense, because you can minimize this field rotation. If you're not going to take super long exposure images, you can still image quite nicely with a driven Altaz mount. You just can't take really long exposures. How long would you say an exposure could be for an unrotated mount?
Well, software gives you a huge advantage because right.
It'll
you
do
know,
the
you
rotation
can do,
for you.
Yeah. You can do some derotation in the software. You just give up the edges of the image. Right. And then you can have tools like derotators. That's how, you know, some of the most premium mounts out there are actually Altaz, to save space in an observatory. But, you know, they have motors that actually turn the camera as it moves to counteract that. But in general, here's the rule of thumb. If it's for visual, Altaz pretty much wins all the time. If it's for imaging, equatorial pretty much wins in every scenario, unless you are in the extreme high end that you're going to use other tools, very expensive tools, to correct that rotation. And the reason is that Altaz, moving left, right, up and down, allows the eyepiece to always be in a very convenient location. Equatorial does not. So imagine having a refractor on an equatorial mount that's tilted back, and then you try to point straight up at zenith. You will literally have to lay on the ground to look through the eyepiece. Whereas with Altaz, the eyepiece is always, you have, you know, what's called a diagonal. It makes the eyepiece come out at a right angle. And the eyepiece is always in a place where you just lean into it and you look. You're never on the ground. You're never trying to, you know, get into these awkward positions to try to look through it. It's just very convenient with Altazimuth.
Right. And so just before we leave this, let me just ask you this, though. With an Altaz mount and you're doing imaging, which you can still do, how long of an exposure do you think you could take before you start to see little arcs in the image? Let's say you don't have any derotation at all. How long of an exposure could you take?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know the answer.
A couple of minutes or so?
Yeah, a few minutes you could get away with for sure. But, you know, I wouldn't push the images into the, you know, an hour or anything like that. You know, I'm sure people do, but again, they have other ways of compensating. So I think that, you know, it's just in general, you just avoid the problem altogether, because you're going to, like, things are moving all the time. The universe never stops for you to take your photo, right? And the earth doesn't stop spinning. So you're always going to have that motion all the time. And because of that arc, no matter what it is you're shooting, you know that you would have had, even if you do that, let's say you do 10 minutes, you know for sure you would have had a sharper image had you been equatorial, because there's some level of rotation no matter how long you're going, because nothing stopped at any point. And so it's just like, why not? If you know you're going to be doing the majority of your time imaging, then get the tool that's designed for imaging. And then you can use it for the other function. Like, you can say, I'm going to use my imaging mount and do visual. You can, but you sacrifice that level of comfort because you know, okay, the thing that I'm going to use it for the least is visual. So I'll just be uncomfortable when I do visual, but the thing I use it for most is imaging. Then it's going to perform really, really well for the thing I'm primarily using it for. And then the other is true too. If it's mostly going to be visual and you're just going to do imaging from time to time, like you, Tony, you got the right thing, man. Altaz.
Yeah.
All the way, yeah. And then just deal with the rotation, because you're not trying to take APODs. You just want to enjoy both sides of the hobby, but most of the time, you're going to...
We've talked about Altazimuth mounts. We've talked about equatorial mounts, what each one does, and whether or not you're going to be using it for primarily for imaging or for visual observing is also really important. But one thing all mounts must have is they must also be sturdy. And that can be relative, right? That could be relative. If all you've got is a 4-inch telescope with maybe a few eyepieces or a camera on the back of it, you don't need to buy something that weighs 100 pounds to mount it on. But it does need to be sturdy enough so that when the tripod or the legs are extended or the pier or whatever it's on, and the equatorial head or the mounting mechanism that connects the optical tube assembly to the tripod, whatever that is, needs to be sturdy, and it needs to move as smoothly as possible. And the reason for that is, and this will be surprise you if you've never used telescopes very much, is that a poorly mounted telescope that's very wobbly on its legs, and you're trying to look through a telescope or through the eyepiece with it, everybody that walks by that telescope, or a slight breeze, or a car driving down a driveway or the road, just a few hundred feet away, you will see those vibrations if you have a poorly mounted telescope. So it must be sturdy. And that's where the expense generally comes in. Although, and Dustin is in a great position to comment on this, a lot of the off-the-shelf stuff that is small and lightweight and portable is pretty darn sturdy. So there's a lot of choices that you can get, but just want to make sure that you want, if you see a telescope, you shake it a little bit with on the tripod and it's a little bit wobbly, run away from it. What you want is something that's firmly attached to the ground and that has knobs that when you loosen them and tighten them, they move smoothly. And all the working mechanisms that can turn and twist are as smooth as they can be. And those are the things you want to look for in your first mount. And there's a ton of really great stuff out there to do that with.
Yeah, somebody right now that's going to be getting into the hobby just got distracted during that part when you were saying that, and they're going to learn that lesson the way we did, the hard way. Yeah, you know, their dog just ran by, and it's going to cost them a lot of frustration by missing that part.
That's right.
But it's true. You don't appreciate how much is going on around you until you're undermounted, so your mount just can't hold the capacity of whatever it is you're doing, or you have a mount that just has too much play in it. It has too much movement in it. Once that happens, you'll notice that, like you mentioned, a car driving by a couple hundred feet away. There's a speed bump in one of my friend's neighborhoods that is several hundred feet away. And when trucks go over that thing, you can't look through the telescope because that comes through the telescope and everything just shakes like crazy. And you don't realize how, like, even things that far away can affect it if you're not mounted properly. You know, you don't have something that's super rigid that can handle that and can handle the weight of the system. I mean, there's a lot of movement here, and this stuff can be pretty heavy at times. And so you think about how much inertia is at play and then sending vibrations through the system. There's a lot that can go wrong. And so, especially when things are slewing and other things, I mean, you want to make sure that you have the capacity. And that's the vocabulary, the next vocabulary word that you'll see when looking at mounts, is they all have a capacity attached to them. And that's how much the mount can actually handle for whichever job it is that it's meant to do, whether visual or imaging.
Yeah. And that's, you still get that kind of vibration when the mount is mounted, the tripod or whatever it is, on the ground itself. And that's another very key component. If you've never looked through a telescope before, you want your telescope on the ground. You don't want it up on a deck or in the second story of your house, because then anybody who's walking on that deck is just going to end up driving you crazy, because you're going to be seeing the image in the eyepiece just jiggle all over the place. So it needs to be on the ground.
It's such a serious thing. I'll tell this quick story, but we had to do a rescue operation for an observatory that was built for one of the owners of a baseball team. You don't have to think too hard to think which baseball team has astronomy attached to it. This observatory they had built. And they thought, you know, we're just going to put it on a second floor because, you know, it'll be cool. Like, we can have this thing that's like way up there. And they didn't realize that attaching anything to that pier, exactly what you're talking about, vibration will travel through that stuff. And so even just having anyone in the building walking up that or moving around, if there's anything touching that pier, every step you will see in the image or, you know, visually looking through the telescope. Same thing in our observatories. We had, this was a funny story, but one of my best friends in the world is the one that helped me build the first four observatories we did. His name's Charles, and he's actually on the Twitch stream sometimes. But the guy is just brilliant. The only reason that any of our stuff works is because he was part of it. But we had been out there, and it was hot, man. We built these things in summer, and we built them by hand. So we're out there digging in the sand and laying the foundations, all this stuff, and we were exhausted. So finally, the concrete truck shows up. Charles is there, and he's like telling him to pour the concrete for the foundation, and you pour this huge concrete in the, you know, for the pier, and then you pour the concrete for the foundation, and they're supposed to be separated so that no vibrations can travel into the pier and up into the telescope. And we were just so spent that Charles was like, they were like, well, what do you want us to do with all the extra concrete? He's like, well, if we got extra, we paid for it, just fill it in. And so he filled in the whole thing, thinking, you know, in that, like, hey, brain dead moment, because we were out in 120 degree heat for 2 months. He's sitting there, and afterwards he calls me. He said, I am so sorry, but I need you to go rent some jackhammers. We just concreted in the pier with the foundation of the building, which means every time wind hits the side of the building, all that vibration is traveling up into the telescope. Every time somebody opens a door or walks through there, anything moves, the whole building moves with the telescope now. So we had to jackhammer tons of concrete away from the pier to isolate it again. And it's that serious. You think that this stuff doesn't matter, but it definitely, definitely does.
I mean, imagine any observatory you've ever seen pictures of. If you go inside, even though it looks like it's built in a building and it's surrounded by structure, if you go to where the pier is, wherever the pier is in that telescope inside that observatory, there is an isolation ring, a gap between where the telescope is mounted and everything else, because that will just transfer over. And that is in every observatory in the world, except for this one. But then they made one, so they had to make an isolation ring.
It's happened a lot. We've done a lot of rescue operations on observatories to go fix that kind of stuff. But yeah, it happens a lot because it's just, again, when would you ever think about something like that unless you're really deep into this hobby? You know, and so, you know, that's people trying to put them on their roofs and all this stuff. And it's like, you have to run that isolated from everything if it's going to be that type of level that you're trying to do long exposure imaging, you know.
Yeah, really wealthy people tend to want to do that. They want to have some kind of dome or something cool on top of their house. And you got to like, well, okay, fine. But you better have a pier going straight through your house that's going through the roof, all the way through the house and down into hopefully bedrock below it, so that thing stays isolated and can work. I mean, the whole point of having these mounts be sturdy is to prevent this vibration from being transferred. And so you have to be real careful of that. And that's also why a lot of portable mounts, and I use that word loosely here, are heavy, because that weight helps to dampen vibration. So one of the things I think I'd like to bring up, Dustin, if you agree, is let's maybe talk about some of the really good commercial mounts that are out there that are kind of not too expensive, but and relatively portable and are good options for people. Do you want to try that?
Sure. Yeah, let's dig in. This is where we get a little more into the weeds with all of this.
Right,
but let's start with the non-go-to options. And I'll tell you some of the experiences that I've had with mounts that I think are really, really excellent. Because the ones that, you know, I've used a ton of mounts and our team has used a ton of mounts. But it's the ones that are great that I think are really worth mentioning here, because those are the directions I feel like people should go if you want to avoid the pitfalls, you know. You start with a mount for something that's really simple. So no go-to, just like AA battery powered, no cables. You don't need a computer. I keep one of these all the time. I actually have one in here that is a star tracking mount for like Milky Way photography, or just getting into deep space photography, or for people that just want it to be really portable. I mean, we with Radian made a tripod specifically for this type of shooting, because it's really common. I mean, how many Milky Way photos have you seen? these are the types of mounts that these are done on. And so one that I definitely have to give credit to here as being among the best is Skywatcher makes one called the Star Adventurer. This is the one that I use, and it's relatively inexpensive. I think it's like somewhere $350-ish up to $400. You have one.
Yeah.
Yeah, there it is.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I'm showing it on the stream. You won't see it here on the podcast. But yeah, these are awesome, and they weigh just a couple pounds.
And look how small that is. I mean, it fits in the palm of your hand. Yeah, it just goes on top of a tripod, and that does exactly the function we're talking about. You throw your camera, your DSLR, your mirrorless camera with a lens on it, and you're off and running and doing long exposure photography, seeing galaxies or nebulae in your images, and definitely things like the Milky Way. So, really, really cool, inexpensive. And a great way to start. They do not have GoTo. So it's not where you can just say, go to the North America Nebula, and then there it is. It doesn't have that. You have to point it at things, and you have to polar align it. So anything equatorial, you do have to polar align.
That's right.
But I think that one, and then Ioptron makes one called the Skyguider Pro. That one, again, it's probably the other most popular one. Really, really great, and super easy to use. That one, they even have one with iPolar, which is like electronic polar alignment. Really, really cool. And I think that those two definitely are the most popular of that class of mount. Really lightweight, not meant to have a huge capacity, and no go-to, but just do the job that they're meant to do.
Yeah, and they can also be special purpose. I bought this one for a PST solar telescope that I have that I just wanted to use it just for looking at the sun. So that's why I have it. So yeah, you're right. Once it's polar aligned, it's good to go. I'll tell you one that I really like real quick, and that is I like the Celestron Nextar 5-inch mount, the one that they have with their 5-inch model. I like that because it's really lightweight. It's go-to, which means that once it knows where it is in the sky, it'll find things for you. But it also has a combination of Altaz mount. It's got that. You can use that as its default mode if you want. But it also has built in a little wedge, a little hinge that lets you recline, like Dustin says, that lets you recline back in and point that fork arm toward the North Pole. And I really liked that feature a lot. And while the alignment procedure required that you know at least three stars, it wasn't that bad. You just had to pick some bright stars. You didn't even have to know what they were. You just had to go to a bright star, center it in the field of view of your eyepiece, and then move it to another star, center it in the eyepiece, and then you really could do it with just two, and then it would do a better job if you had three, and then you were polar aligned. It knew where everything was, and you could go to town with it. So it's a really good scope, and I think highly of that particular model.
It is. It is for entry level kind of photography. It doesn't have the best tracking capability. It's not really meant for long exposure astrophotography, but for people that are getting into it that want, again, primary function is going to be visual, but you just want to test the waters with astrophotography. It's awesome. Like you said, it's really lightweight too. You can carry that thing anywhere. Yeah,
I know.
You can carry it anywhere.
You fold up the thing and you're done. You put it in your car and carry it around, and you'll be able to take it to dark skies, which helps its performance. And so anyway, that's one of the ones I wanted to point out. I think it's really good.
Yeah. And then from there, people generally go up to the next level, the 25-pound kind of capacity. Ioptron makes really, really great mounts in this realm. Celestron makes one called the AVX. It's also extremely popular. And there are a few. People start there usually where they're like, all right, I still want to use the same camera, but I want to put a telescope on it. This would be something like with the new Radian Raptor, the 61mm. This would be more than enough. Those last two mounts we mentioned would handle that, but these would be more than enough and give you go-to and give you the whole astrophotography experience of doing long exposures. So I think that's where people usually go because they can get into it for under $1,000 and get a nice piece of equipment that's going to last a really long time. Some people skip that step and go right into their like, all right, I've done my Milky Way stuff, or I just know I saw these photos and I'm addicted. That's kind of where I was like, I got to take these photos. So they just go right into a higher capacity mount where they're going to have more room later on you know, buy once, cry once kind of thinking.
I know. I love that saying.
Yeah. And it's like, all right, well, I know I'm going to do this and it's more expensive, but I'm going to spend $1,500 or $2,000 and really get a mount that has more capacity. If I want to get a bigger telescope later, I can, but it's a little more future proofed. And that's where mounts like the Skywatcher EQ6R do extremely well, or some of the higher capacity Ioptron mounts, or, you know, there are a bunch, even all the way up to like Hobum mounts, you know, and that's where you have to kind of decide what level, what quality, what tracking do you feel like you need, and what's your budget, because it can get expensive in a hurry. You know, the difference between like an AVX at $700 or $800 and a Hobum mount, you know, starting at $3,500 is significant, but one is literally professional grade and harmonic drives, and the other is meant to be like the stepping stone in astrophotography, or just the ultra portable option for people, you know, that don't want to go spend $3,500 or more, you know? And so
yeah, when you're in that level of mount, then the issues become slightly different. You're looking at things like tracking accuracy, and all of that stuff becomes paramount.
Yeah, and that's where, you know, I mean, when you're getting into software BISC mounts, astrophysics mounts, plane wave mounts, harmonic drive mounts like Hobum, that's where you know, like, all right, at this point, you're already kind of identifying as an imager. Like, you're really spending time, you're really wanting to do this, and that's where that stuff really starts to matter. Like, for me, the excitement now is pushing myself and really trying to get my best images. And so I don't want the equipment. I want to be the limiting factor. I don't want the equipment to be the limiting factor. And so that's why, to me, it's worth it to just buy the mount once, even if it's more expensive on the front end. You know, it's the piece that will be the limiting factor in your images if you don't get something that just has like the best tracking capability, to where when you're guiding, you're always sub arc second accuracy, to where, you know, your images are not going to be limited by the mount's ability. It's all going to be your ability. And that's really where you want to be. And that's why, you know, I use a lot of really high-end mounts. But again, the mount is the thing that I think anybody that does a lot of imaging is going to tell you, put your money there first, because that's the thing that's going to make your images what they are.
And there's always going to be a trade-off, right? You're always going to have a trade-off between portability and weight and all of these other things that Dustin was just talking about, the tracking accuracy and the professionalism and all of these things that you get with some of these high-end mounts. So you want to try and, well, sometimes you want to try and just get that envelope just right for your own needs. But some of these mounts, I mean, they will make your night under the stars about as pleasurable as it could be. I mean, just moving some of these mounts, operating them, turning the knobs, moving the telescope from one spot to another is a delight. And you will use it every chance you get, because this is where the engineering pays off, is when your interaction with this telescope. And it will all happen through the mount, with the exception of the focuser and maybe the camera. But these mounts that we're talking about are really for people who've already drunk the Kool-Aid, and they know that they're in this thing for life. So
yeah, the Kool-Aid. So it's definitely one of those things where as you start using nicer mounts, you never look back. Because it's just like you said, your night is so much more enjoyable when you're looking at your guiding and it's just a flat line, just perfect. You know, every image you get is going to be so ridiculously sharp. And that's what premium mounts do for you. And it doesn't have to be super expensive. I would say even mounts, like we just mentioned, the EQ6R. I think that one, off the top of my head, man, I don't have all the SKUs memorized, but I think that's somewhere in the range of $1,500. That mount is phenomenal. And people are taking APODs with that mount. You know, they're getting NASA APOD awards with that mount. So it doesn't have to be like go out and spend $10,000. Really, what you end up paying for when you go into the bigger mounts, like $10,000 plane wave mount, is capacity. You're going to be able to hold really big systems that, you know, you can hold multiple hundreds of pounds on some of these bigger mounts. And, you know, that's really what you're buying, is when you want to get into a really big CDK or RC and just go after these super faint targets, or an observatory class mount. that's where they get pretty expensive, unless you're looking to bring observatory class portable. And those are the ones that I talk about all the time, is because I'm like the biggest fan of this idea, which is the most portable mounts right now are actually mounts that are, you know, the smallest, but they're very expensive because they're harmonic drives. But, you know, harmonic drives have this unbelievable torque, and, you know, they don't have one of the two problems. So you have periodic error is a problem in mounts with gears, and then backlash is another problem with mounts and gears. And the only one that they suffer from is periodic error, but because it's periodic, you can correct it out. It's predictable. And so you can correct that to where that problem is eliminated. And backlash is something that all geared mounts have that harmonic drives don't suffer from. But these mounts, because of their incredible torque, like the one I use here has a 55 pound capacity. It can carry 55 pounds and it weighs 11. It weighs 11 pounds. So harmonic drives can carry five times their weight. And that's something that I think, you know, and they don't have to use counterweights if you're not maxing out the stuff. And so for me, like portability, not carrying around counterweights, not having to balance it like that, that's awesome, man. It's just some steps eliminated.
I'm so glad you brought that up. That's huge, because counterweights, by the word weight, you know, they add what they're heavy. And so they're just one more thing you've got to lug around that makes your night a little bit more, you know, of a workout.
Right.
Now, let me ask you this. So of these, I'm glad you brought that, the portability issue up, because of these class of mounts, the 1500 to the 3000 or the Hobom mounts, those kind of things, how portable are they? You've already said the harmonic drive of the Hobom is pretty darn portable and lightweight, which is the best of everything. What about some of the others? Yeah. Are they pretty portable?
So the Hobom is the same size as the tracker that you just held up. So the smallest Hobom is the same size as that, but it's the, you know, the same tracking capability as anything that you'd see in an observatory. So it's really, really small. I think it weighs 4 pounds, 5 pounds, something mm-hmm. like that, wow. You know, so really, really small. When you get into the other mounts, generally, they are going to weigh a lot closer to what their capacity is. And so at best, you're going to see it be like 1 to 2. So if a mount, say, weighs like 30 pounds, 35 pounds, it can generally carry like 50, you know, and that would be really good. It's only because of the nature of harmonic drives where you can get into the five times its weight kind of stuff. You know, but it's not one of those things where you're going to be able to go out and get a 10 pound mount that's normal gearing that can carry, you know, 50 or 60 or 100 pounds or anything like that. It's going to be close to what they weigh, relatively close to what they weigh. Best case scenario is generally about half of what they weigh. So 25 pounds, maybe you can get away with 50 on some really nice mounts.
Yeah, and on a German equatorial, at least you have to also then worry about the weight that will go on the other side of that telescope
exactly.
to balance it. So that'll add a lot to it as well.
You have to,
and all of that affects portability.
Yeah, exactly. You have to counterweight them to make sure that you keep the strain off the gears as this thing's moving around. And that means exactly you have to carry around some additional weights, and they're heavy, and it's another step in the process. But look, I mean, this is just part of it. Most 99% of mounts require counterweights, and they always have, and it's not going away anytime soon. There are only a couple of types of mounts that don't.
So while we wrap up this podcast, I want to ask you, so we've gone through the whole journey of mounts and what they do and the things to look out for. What's your favorite? If you had to pick a mount, what's your best mount out there that you love the most?
I really love my Hobom mounts, the harmonic drive stuff, because you know, they're not the ones I use in my observatories. I use software bisque mounts in the observatories. And those I've had there for a long time, actually before the Hobom mounts came out. But the Hobom mounts is what I use at home. I have 3 Hobom mounts here at home. And the reason I like it is because I like being out under the stars. If they're remote observatories, I found that plane wave mounts are absolutely just unbelievable. Those are direct drive, so they don't have any of the gearing. They're, you know, magnetic. They're driven by magnets, so they don't have any backlash, any periodic error. They're incredible. The software bisque mounts are, you know, made in the United States, AP mounts made in the United States. Some of these are the best mounts ever, and they have a reputation for being flawless, and they are really, really good. These are all, I mean, we're talking ultra premium mounts right now, by the way.
Yeah, yeah, state of the art.
But what I like about the Hobom is that I can throw it in my backpack along with my lenses, you know, and all this stuff, and just go. And my tripod weighs, that holds it, weighs 4 pounds, and I can just bring everything with me and go, and it gets me out, because I find even something small, like if I have to pack around counterweights, it's just one more thing that makes me hesitate on whether or not I want to go through all of the effort that night. And maybe I'm being super lazy there, but it's like, you know, sometimes you're tired or whatever. You've had a long day and, you know, you want to go image because you're excited, but you're just like, man, it's one more thing to do. It's another step. It's another thing to carry. It's another thing to pack, travel with, you know? And so I love that they don't require the step of me balancing them. I don't have to put on counterweights or counterweight shaft. And they have polar scope, electronic polar scope tools, mounting brackets built in. So you throw the electronic polar scope on there, and it even does that step for you, man. So it's just like, I really like that. I understand that not everybody's going to want it, especially if you're testing the waters. It's probably not wise to go out and spend $5,000 or $6,000 on a mount, you know? And I didn't start with those. I started with the ones, like I was saying, that were $800 and, you know, $1,000, and you have great experiences. But the counterweight piece for me was huge. And a lot more people now are going in on that first Hobom mount. It's called the Traveler. They are going in on that. Anybody that's interested in looking at them, they're called H-O-B-Y-M, Hobom. And I mean, they're all over our website. You'll see them a lot there. They're pretty popular anymore. But a lot of people are just saying, you know what, I just want to be one and done. And so they buy those mounts now and travel with them and stuff. But I think those are great. And I really like the EQ6R because it's accessible, you know, $1,500. I really like that. And I see great results with it. My buddy, Trevor, you know, he talks about it all the time. Astro Backyard. And look at his images. Like, they're so ridiculously good. And he didn't have to go spend $3,500 or $5,000 to get them. So I like that a lot too, you know, but there are a lot of great mounts out there. Those are just two that come to mind.
Which is more state of the art, the Hobom mounts or the plane wave mounts, the direct drive, the magnetic ones?
They're two different monsters. Direct drive
which pushes
wins.
The opposite.
Yeah, direct drive wins on everything other than portability. You know, but they're so, I mean, we're talking about, they're so close that your tracking is going to be better than your seeing conditions. So does it matter? No, not at all. It's not going to show in your image because the sky above you is worse than the tracking mount. But plane wave mounts are not portable. These are observatory mounts, and they're meant to be in an observatory. Hobom mounts are meant to be observatory class out in the field. So they're two completely different kind of approaches.
Yeah, that's a good distinction. But it's sort of a statement about where we are in this hobby now. Professional grade stuff is available to routinely now on the amateur astronomy market. So this is a great time to be getting out there and learning how to use some of these telescopes. One of the things we didn't mention that I want to make sure we do mention in the class of mounts that we've been talking about, especially the ones that have clock drives on them that counteract the Earth's rotation, there are generally two styles of those. One of them is a fork mounted. That's where you'll see something like Celestron will have fork mounts with an optical tube assembly in the center. And then you'll have the German equatorial, which Dustin mentioned earlier. I wanted to bring up the fork mount because they tend to be smaller in size, and you're able to put them in a case and travel around with them. It's all one unit, usually. Usually it's the optical tube assembly, the fork is attached, and the clock drive, all, and you just put that on a tripod of some beefiness. And so they tend to be a lot more portable as well. I just wanted to point that out because German equatorial mounts have been around forever, but they're a little bit ungainly. They're a little bit kind of, you got to work with them, counterweights, all that stuff is involved. So I just wanted to make sure I mentioned those two styles of mounts as well. I think we've covered most of it.
Yeah. And you know what's funny? When you talk about my favorite mounts, man, I probably should mention that if anyone asks me which mount do I use the most, it might still be my Star Adventurer, the one that you just lifted up. You know, mm-hmm. The little $400 mount. I still use that thing, probably 100 times a year. I use that thing all the time. And
just no beating it.
No, I mean, no I just... beating. I talk about the AA experience. It's tough to beat a AA experience where there's just no cables, there's nothing. You go out there, and sometimes you don't care to go out and get the best image in the world. Sometimes you just want to go out and be under the night sky and have something that's just easy and just fun to be out with, you know? And so I grab that because it's so light, it's so portable. You can leave it on the tripod, plop it down, throw a camera on there, and you're off and running in 20 seconds. I love that, man. I use it all the time.
There's no beating the ease of use and portability. I mean, those two things will make you will go out and use it. If all you've got to do is grab and go, man, you're going to do that. Other than looking at a 100-pound telescope, going, I'm not so sure, man. Maybe I'll stay inside.
Exactly. It gets me outside. It gets me outside. And I love that the on-off switch on it is just a picture of the stars. So it's like if the light is off, you're off. And then there's a little star and like a moon. And it's like, you want to track the stars? Turn it to the star. You want to track the moon? Turn it to the moon. It's like, it's so easy. And I really like that about it.
Yeah. All right. Well, great. All right. Well, I hope this has helped you guys listening to maybe get your head around what some of these mounts are and maybe sort of simplify some of the terms for you and what to really look for in a halfway decent mount. You're going to want something sturdy and that's mounted to the ground, something that is easy to use or at least well machined so that it doesn't vibrate too much. And there's lots of styles to pick from there. So we hope this has helped you a little bit understand the world of mounts. We will be talking about them many, many times in future episodes, so don't worry about that. And so on behalf of Dustin Gibson, I'm Tony Darnell. I want to thank you all so much for listening. And as always, keep looking up. Space Junk is produced by Deep Astronomy and sponsored by OPT Telescopes in Carlsbad, California. Please visit our website at spacejunkpodcast.com. Also, please send any questions and comments or ideas for new episodes to spacejunk@deepastronomy.com.